Hi, this is Dave Cousins of the Straws. You're watching Rock of Nations with Dave and Shane.
Hey everybody, this is Joe Linter.
Hi everybody, this is Rob Halford.
The Rudy Sargent.
Hey there, this is Steve Hackett.
Hey folks, this is Rick Emmett of Triumph.
And we're talking rock with Dave and Shane.
I'm just going to go and get something, if I may, which I'm
sure, please, absolutely.
Is the album sleeve.
That would be wonderful. Yes. We got to get a live look here at the album sleeve, the magic of it all. Straub's new record, new music. Brother Shane, this stuff, man. We love those previews, huh?
Yeah, it's fantastic. Fantastic record. So,
yeah,
the songs I've heard online on Spotify so far are just amazing.
And David has looks like a magical 12-string. 12-string guitar in the background.
Well, the 12-string guitar, belongs to a friend of mine around the corner. I'm restringing it for him. My actual guitar that I have here that I play and write and sing on is this one.
Wow. Oh, that's beautiful.
Beautiful.
Tell us about, what's the story behind that one?
The story behind this one is the most amazing story. I saw it, it's a Sweet 16, Gretsch Sweet 16.
Beautiful.
I saw it advertised on eBay about 20 years ago, and I paid $200 for it. Straub songs tell stories. They're not just "I love you, babe," you know, "do you fancy a bit?" You know, we're not like that. These songs are what's happening in my life. And the album's got songs written about the fact that the world is changing around us as we speak. Even now in Spain, I just looked up a few minutes ago and saw that the ground temperature in Spain is over 60 degrees. You walk out on it with bare feet and you get your feet singed. Yes. So the climate is changing around us all the time. And also, we've got huge migration move. The whole population is moving because water is drying up in Africa. People are moving to find water. But in moving, they're also moving not only to find water, they're moving to find a better way of life.
Yeah.
And so there's this huge migration going on and the climate change all at the same time. So the world is changing dramatically around us. And that comes out on the album too.
Yeah, it does. This is just a little bit different topic, but I was doing some research because I'm a big collector, and Bursting at the Seams, Hero, Heroin, Dragonfly, and the Straub's first album are fairly hard to find in the US. And it doesn't seem like there's any reissues in sight because of A&M being dissolved. Is there any plan for like a comprehensive reissue program, like some of the stuff, the reissues that Stephen Wilson did with Gentle Giant, you know, like one by one getting them remixed? Yeah, and
I can't talk much about it, but yeah. Universal own our back catalog, and yeah. I have lawyers talking to Universal at the moment and about negotiating with Universal. That's all I can say, because otherwise it might be misinterpreted or something. If something Universal were watching and said, "Well, we don't know about this," but there's a slight. I can explain one thing, which is the fact that we first of all, when we first signed with A&M, we were signed to the US label, despite the fact we were living in the UK. We were the first British band actually signed to A&M Records in Hollywood, believe it or not. Wow. Well before Cat Stevens or any of that other, Joe Cocker, well before that, Straws were their first British band.
Wow.
And when our big records came about in the UK, our contract was moved to the UK. And so at the moment that we have two contracts, one with A&M Universal in the USA and another contract with A&M Universal in the UK. And then the lawyers are sorting that out first. That'll that's the first thing to sort out, and then we can get down to see where we can go.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, fingers crossed there, no doubt. Well, this boy, there's so much history here. I mean, there's so much, you know.
They could talk for hours.
Yeah, we really could. Like, I didn't realize you guys were the first British band on A&M. Yeah, that's awesome.
Was a little interesting tidbit I found a couple of weeks ago about you, and I had no idea that you were the voice on this, but huge Def Leppard fan and On yes. Through the Night.
Yes.
You did the voice at the beginning of When the Walls Come Tumbling Down. Do you have any memories of that, or how did that all come about?
when our management said we're winding the band up, I said, I went off and I thought, well, I'll go back and play some folk clubs. And I got Brian Willoughby to come in guitar with me. And I went round the clubs. And whenever we went to Sheffield, Joe Elliott and the guitar player, I can't remember his name now, used to come and literally sit at our feet and watch us play. And we became good friends. In fact, Joe gave me the very first EP that they put out when they first issued it. And it was in a red cover, and I can't find it anywhere. I know I've got it, but I can't find it. It so happened then that they chose as a producer Tom Allen, who used to produce our albums.
Oh, yeah.
There's possibly a little connection there. And I walked in to see Tom when they were recording, wherever they were recording. And Joe was reading the lyrics, and he said, I can't get this. Dave, you come and read these lyrics. You read this for me. And so I went in and said, and the walls came tumbling down. And they were absolutely delighted, and they put the record out, and people were absolutely astonished that Dave Cousins on a Def Leppard album. But I did it. Anyway, about 10 years ago, ELP did a last farewell concert in London, in Finsbury Park, and Def Leppard were on the bill. And I saw Joe backstage, and I went up to him and I said, if I were to say to you, and walls came tumbling down, what would you say to me? He turned around and said, fucking Shakespeare. And then we gave another bill.
I love it.
I forgot how tall he is.
Yeah.
I hope you find that EP.
Oh, yeah. what did you make? I mean, you know, at the time when, you know, there's definitely a new wave of British heavy metal, they call it, you know, I think when Def Leppard broke and, you know, what did you make of kind of that next sort of evolution of rock, British rock and roll? Was it like, wow, this is really heavy? I mean, did it kind of or
never struck me as being particularly heavy, because when on a good day we could be quite heavy.
Yeah
but it's right, not that it so happened that I moved down to the coast in England, into a little town called Deal near Dover, which is the nearest place to France, and just up the road was a studio run by Chris Tangarides, who was one of the biggest producers of British heavy metal. Gary Moore, Yngwie Malmsteen, he produced Priest, all of those albums. Later. And he lived 4 or 5 miles from my house. And wow. So I went up there one day and said, hi, I'm Dave. Do you remember? He said, come on in. I remember. I know exactly who you are. He said, you won't believe this, but I was a tape op on your album, Grave New World. Wow. No, Bursting Seams.
First
he said, I was a tape op. And so suddenly there we were chatting away to one another. He knew exactly. And I look back on it. I remember the young kid sitting there at the end with a tape machine, running it down with long curly hair down, halfway down his back. And then he didn't have any hair by then when I met up with him. But that didn't matter. But he produced the last 4 or 5 Straubs albums, and did a wonderful job. And then sadly he passed away. Yeah, but we actually formed a record label together called Dark Lord, because that was his nickname. Mm. And we started putting out new albums by heavy metal bands. And people don't know I've done that either.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Are you a huge fan of heavy metal, or are you just a casual fan?
I better explain about my the way in which I listen to music. I don't listen to music. I hear music. It's a great difference, I think. And when I listen to a record and it's playing, I hear a sound. There is a sound that I hear and I get from a record. When I first heard Bob Dylan, I heard the sound of Woody Guthrie. I heard it in my head. I couldn't tell you one word that Bob Dylan has written. I've only ever sung one of his songs once, Tambourine Man, and I couldn't remember the words of that. But anyway, that's not the point, is that I listened, I heard the sound of it, and I loved the sound of it. I loved the sound of Jackson Browne's albums. He's got an atmosphere about his records, and that Staying Alive album he made when he split up with Hannah. Was a wonderful record, and the sound of that record I love. Again, I couldn't tell you one word on it because I don't listen to the words. I listen to the sound of the record. And I don't listen to records just to say, wow, that's a fabulous guitar solo, or what a wonderful bass line. I don't listen for that. I listen for the sound and the atmosphere of the record. And so I don't, if a heavy metal track comes on that has got a really good melody to it, then I can really get into that and enjoy it. But if it drones on just thudding away for half an hour it's very some boring chord sequence, then I'm not inspired by that because the sound doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah.
But I have heard heavy tracks that I love. I love the first Love album when that came out, but my favourite track on that was the Alone Again Or. That to me, that was a wonderful track, and that inspired the end of the Shepherd's Song when you hear on the album From the Witchwood, when we play a flamenco guitar part and Rick Wakeman then put a mellotron on top of it, which happened to be in the studio, and also the studio recording and had the first Bob Moog's first Moog synthesizer in the UK in it. And so Tony Visconti tuned that to a piccolo trumpet sound. And that was the end of that. But that was inspired by the sound of that Alone Again Or track. So that's the way in which I'm more inspired by things. I'm not inspired by, as I say, by the greatest guitar solo in the world. And it will probably surprise you if I told you that the best person I've ever seen on stage was Prince, without a shadow of a doubt, the most talented musician, unbelievable guitar player, wonderful piano player, and performer, singer. He had everything, and absolutely the best thing I've ever seen. And the thing inspired me, if you like, most of all, was when he did the 20 minutes in the middle of the I can't remember which game it is, in the pouring rain.
The Super Bowl, halftime show, best
ever show.
That was just out of this world. The fact that he had the balls to do it and the guts to do it, because he could have got killed himself if he just touched that mic. He could have gone up in smoke.
Yeah,
but he did it, and what a phenomenal performer.
Yeah.
But so that probably surprises you, thinking I'm probably an old folky who loves listening to tiddle diddle.
Not at all.
No, not at all.
No.
Prince was just I never got to see him live, and it's one of my biggest regrets. I mean, just a force of nature. I mean, just otherworldly, just amazing.
Yeah, I think the loss of David Bowie and Prince within a few years of each other was that was devastating to a lot of us. Yeah. Were you a Bowie fan too? Tony also famously worked with David. And did you ever have?
I knew David very well before he became famous, because he was a friend of Tony Visconti. Was actually living together with him, and David Bowie ran his arts lab, as he called it, a weekly, which are equivalent of a folk club, but more, towards the arty side of music, and he invited us to go and play. And I invited him back to my arts lab, and he came over and played on his own. And it was the week that, Ground Control to Major Tom came out.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And there he was playing to about 80 people in a room, singing that song the week it came out in a little tiny pub just around the corner from my house. So we got to know one another very well.
What was he like? What was he like as a, you know, as a person? We know him as the artist, but what was he like as the person?
Very, he was a very nice guy. He used to come around to my house for a cup of tea. I don't know, it sounds strange.
We didn't
have much furniture. He used to sit on the floor and have a cup of tea, and we chatted away about songs. The sort of music I was interested in, sort of music he was interested in. I was singing my latest one, then he'd sing me one of his songs. It was a very, very friendly relationship. And I, because of the radio show that we were doing, the London News, it was called, I actually did a lovely interview with David. And it was at the time he suddenly put out The Man Who Sold the World. Yeah. And so I asked him about wearing the dress. And he said, that was on the front cover, he was wearing a woman's dress. And he said, oh, I thought it's such a beautiful dress. I just wanted to put it on and wear it. He said, I thought it was a beautiful thing. And then I interviewed him about, I said, well, how was your first American tour? And then he owned up about it and said, I've got all this on tape. He said, when I got there, I didn't have a visa. So I couldn't actually go and play any clubs anywhere. So all I did was house concerts, and that's all I could do. This was him before he became famous. Yeah. So I knew him well when he did his first ever American tour.
Amazing.
Yeah. Were you ever approached about releasing the interview, or has anybody ever contacted you to get that?
No, I've got it, but I published it in my book. My Exercising Ghosts. I did a transcript of it. But the Bowie estate might come down around my neck if I put it out. Geez.
Oh, man. What a piece of history, though. Oh, my gosh. What a piece of history. I love that. You've had these experiences. You must just get, chills sometimes, pinch me moments.
I went into the radio business, I carried on being just as creative as I was when I was making music, except it was a totally different way of life. And when I got to the radio station, I was appointed program controller. And the reason I got the job as one program controller, or as you would call it, program director of one of the first 19 commercial radio stations in the country, was because I'd been producing all of those shows for Danish radio. And so I got the job, and my secretary came in on my first day and said, Do you want to do the mail first or the schedule? I said, no, put your notepad down. I said, what do I have to do? she said, well, you're in charge of everything that goes out on the air. She said, what, 24 hours a day? Yes, you're in charge of everything that goes out. I said, what, news as well? She said, yep, you're in charge of the news as well. So I said, oh, okay. Well, we better get on. And so I went from being a rock singer into being program director of a radio station, never having worked in a radio station.
That's amazing. Yeah.
But I then came up with an idea. I wanted to do a series of programs called Rock of Ages, about how the spiritual beliefs of leading songwriters have influenced their songwriting. The first person we interviewed was Bob Marley, in England, talking about he was only about 6 months before he died. He had his foot up in plaster. He'd broken his toe playing football, and he was smoking a joint that long, But we didn't ask him questions about, tell us about reggae, tell us about this and your latest single. We talked to him about being a Rastafarian, And then we put that into a program with his music, explaining how the music was influenced by his religious beliefs. Mm. The second show I did was with a guy called Yusuf Islam, Cat yeah. Stevens.
That's right.
I knew him as Steve. We did several shows with him in our early days. And he just changed to become Yusuf Islam. And I was the first person to interview him after he made the move into become Yusuf Islam. Wow. So I talked to him about his beliefs. And the third person I interviewed was Pete Townsend about being a disciple of Meir Barber. Mm-hmm. And so all of the songs that were written for Tommy are all about his spiritual beliefs. People don't know this. So I've got all that on tape. They're unbelievable programs.
And then
I picked up a tape by George Harrison talking about his writing Here Comes the Sun and things like that, which is all very spiritual. And then I went over to America, to WNEW in New York, and I was given an album of the interview that Bob had just done of when he became a Christian. And they only pressed up 100 copies of that album to give out to people like myself or to other radio stations to play. And so I used that for my own radio station and turned that into part of the Rock of Ages series. So I've got those tapes. I've had them all restored. They're just sitting on my computer.
That's amazing.
That's a fantastic concept.
Oh, yeah. I love that concept. Yeah. I mean, it's like you go deep into it's beyond the music. You go deep into the spirituality, the culture, all of these things, you know, the mindset, everything.
Yes, you find out what the songs mean.
Yeah.
And when you hear that the seeker, for example, the Who's song, The Seeker, they seek him here, they seek him there. But when Pete Townsend explains it, he said, well, you're sitting in your living room. He might be behind the sofa. He might be up behind a chair. You're looking, but you don't know where God is.
Yeah.
You know, but it's explained in a very humble and strange way, but explaining why he wrote the song. And that is gold dust, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It's divine. I mean, yeah. It's incredible. Yeah.
Man, Recently, Steve Lukather from Toto was talking about, and maybe you know, you can comment on this because you were in that other end, the radio spectrum of things, but he made a comment. I'll just quote him here. If you don't have 1 million followers on Instagram, you could write Sergeant Pepper's and nobody's going to take it. He thinks the business is going backwards right now. Is that something that you agree with, or do you think it's still wide open?
It's difficult to say, but I actually think that the music business has changed for the worst with downloading with Spotify and etc. Because people don't take any. When I used to go out and buy an album, it was something I treasured because albums were expensive, but you take it home and pick up a piece of plastic, I'll hold it up again, but that
yes.
Size.
Please do, yeah.
And you open it up and you read the lyrics on the inside, but you could actually have something physical in your hand that you bought and you spent money on. And therefore you treasured it much more than just pushing a button and hearing something. You don't listen to it deeply. And there's a skill in making an album for vinyl, in planning the running order for it.
Yeah.
And it's, you don't just put the tracks in any old order. I don't anyway. For a start, you constrict it to 20 minutes a side, which means that you have to work out and balance the sides to 20 minutes each. You can't have one side at 25 and the other side at 16.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work. So, and also you have to appreciate that as the needle gets closer to the center of the album, the needle is, let me explain. When the needle on a vinyl record is going up and down for the treble and from side to side with the bass. The needle is moving all the time. So when it gets, the grooves when you're on the outside edges are very wide, and therefore you get more bass on the outside of an album. But when you get towards the center of the album, the grooves become much tighter. And therefore, you can't put a track in the middle of the album that's got very heavy bass on it. Otherwise, you won't get the bass through. You won't get it out. So that has to be taken into account as well. Then there are the keys of the songs, and then there's the actual timing of the songs. So I set up a spreadsheet, and I digitized the timing. So 3 minutes 30 seconds becomes 3.50 minutes, and then I can add it all up and I keep a running, and it's adding up as I go along. I can move one song there and move that song over there. And the computer is adding it up and balancing it all the time. And then you have to make sure that you don't put two songs in the key of E together or the key of D together. Otherwise, you spoil the effect of it. So an awful lot of planning goes into that running order. And I worked for at least 2 days on this running order of that album, just to juggling with the songs to find out which the best running order was. Now, in the end, I found it, and I'm really thrilled with it. But that is a skill that people don't realize when they listen to the radio now. They don't know that that's happened. But again, I think that the fact that people get it for free, unless if they take the adverts with it, they don't value the money anymore. They don't value the recording. That people who buy the vinyl album value it. Yeah. And so that, I think, has affected business. Also, the return that the artists are getting on royalties is dismally poor.
Yeah,
that's why an awful lot of bands from my era are having to go out to go and play anywhere just to earn a retirement pension, if you like, because they don't not earning any royalties to keep them going, as their pension fund doesn't exist in royalties terms. So they're having to go out and work live. Now, I can't go out and work live because I've got this condition. So I've got to rely on making records. And that's why we concentrate on making records that look nice. There's the actual CD version of it with a nice little booklet inside. And that's all worked out as well. Yeah. There's a picture of outside the album studio.
Nice.
That's everything like that is you make pennies compared with what we used to make in terms of royalties.
Yeah, it's crazy. But
the record companies themselves are making fortunes.
Yeah. Well, the CEO of like Spotify, and you know, it was one of the most obnoxious things when. And yes, the show's on Spotify, of course, but so we walked the balance. But you know, he said that a couple of years ago, he said, or 3 years ago, he said, artists just have to do more. They have to. And it was just like the most, like, are you serious kind of comment, you know, like talk about not being able to read the room. And that's to say the least, like to say the artists have to do more. Yeah. They've already given us, you know, masterpieces, you know, bodies of work, and they should be compensated fairly and adequately, and that's not happening.
No, he's paying the record companies, and the record companies are taking the cream of the money. But yeah. We were the small record company, and we work out a deal whereby they pay us a reasonable amount of money or the royalties that come from digitizing. But the only money you can, I believe, they make nowadays is if we sell a lot of vinyl, because you charge more for it. Right. It costs a lot more money to produce, but you make money out of that.
Is that the first thing you hope to do when all this stuff with Universal is settled?
I would love to be able to put the old albums out and remaster them and do them. Not properly, because in their day they were done as well as we could possibly could. Yeah, but with modern technology, you can really, the sound can be improved enormously.
Yeah. David Coverdale was talking about that with us about a couple months ago, about just, you know, bringing it, it's not changing the essence of the art, but it's, you know, bringing it up so it meets the technology to play it so that we can experience it in the modern sort of era, you know, which makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. The difficulty is that people's hearing, and the older you get, deteriorates. And everybody knows you don't necessarily go deaf, but you lose it. You lose top frequencies. Yeah. And so I hear less top frequencies. So I don't, some things, it came home to me when I was watching the coronation on the television a couple of months ago, when I was looking at the musicians playing at the in the cathedral, and there was a violin section and French horn section. I could hear the French horns, I couldn't hear the violins, and I suddenly realized that my top frequencies are really deteriorating. Wow. And it makes it difficult for me when we're making an album. That's why Blue's got much better hearing than I have. That I don't hear the subtleties at the top end that he's putting on necessarily. And so that it breaks my heart, but there you go, learn to live with it. So I'm going to make some records that just got bottom end in future. Funk.
But some funk, yeah, some drums and bass.
All funk from this point on.
Go back to the Prince inspiration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, I mean, this is just... this has been such a joy. We could talk to you for hours, Dave Cousins. I mean, yeah, we really could. Yeah. You know, Straub's the magic of it all.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Oh my Thank God. You, sir.
Well, it's been wonderful.
It's lucky, we're not talking about, you know, some people say, can you tell me about how the band started? People can read about that elsewhere. Right. There's plenty of it on Wikipedia, et cetera. They can pick it up there. It's much more interesting to have a free-ranging conversation like we've had.
Yeah.
Where we explore different avenues, and nobody would have known about the tapes that I've got sitting here if we hadn't been talking like this now.
It's mind-blowing. Yeah, I'm jazzed. It's mind-blowing. Absolutely.
I would give anything to hear them. I really would. I hope you get a chance to get them released somehow. YouTube or something.
It'd be wonderful, but as I say, the difficulty might be that they've got music alongside it. Yes, fair enough. They're the songs that they're illustrative. But of course, there are royalties to pay for on that. If I was to put them up for sale, you'd have to come to an arrangement with the copyright companies about that, which is not difficult to do. I don't think, but you'd have to get permission for it.
Yeah.
And do it. There's no point in doing it underhand, and you know,
right.
But you could do it. You got to do it properly.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's worth that to do it absolutely properly. And yeah, absolutely. Wow.
But I have a goofy question real quick, cause I have to ask this for somebody, but they're a big fan and they love the song, The River, on Bursting at the Seams, which is obvious, it's a very, very engaging melody. I love the song, but it clocks in at just over 2 minutes. And they wanted to know, is there a longer version, perhaps with a jam or something, still in the vaults of the river?
No, not to my knowledge, there isn't. No, no, it was a short song, very, very, very reflective song. About breaking up with my first wife, etc. And so it's a very poignant song, but it was very I was in at that time. I loved the idea of putting songs together to make them to have two or three songs joined together.
Yeah,
it wasn't very good for copyright purposes, but it was a good
yeah. Wow, man, amazing.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, well, Dave Cousins, thank you so much.
And I hope we'll do it again.
Please. Yes. Oh, mate, we've got so many more questions.
When the next album comes out.
Absolutely. Perfect.
And we didn't even get to talk about Sandy Denny either, so.
I know.
that's a whole new... I could spend the same time we spent now talking about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unbelievable voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's one of the songs I will be singing at the last night is Ringing Down the Years. Yeah. I don't know if you know that song.
Yes.
Yep.
It was written about Sandy. Every song you ever sang comes ringing down the ears.
Wow.
It's going to be, it'd be very difficult to sing because I'll probably choke up, but there you go. Oof.
Yeah.
Do you consider her to be one of the best of all time?
Oh, yes. Very much so. Definitely. Absolutely. She could make you shiver. She could, yeah. In one note, she could go from soft to loud, and you would just, you really would shiver because of not the technique of it, just that what we were talking about, the sound of it, the sound of her voice is extraordinary.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wow. Yeah, such a brilliant talent.
With that, I shall wish you farewell.
Dear Cousins, it's such a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Yeah!